Money FM 89.3, best of your money. Money and Me on Your Money, only on Money FM 89.3.
The first U.S. presidential debate saw Biden and Trump hurling insults at each other. Viewers may have cringed, but stocks rose. The S&P 500 rose 0.8%. Futures rose as much as 0.7% during the debate, well within the range of swings that have prevailed during one of the U.S. stock market's more volatile stretches. We digest the market's reaction to the first U.S. presidential debate in a short while. J.P. Morgan, bullish on the S&P 500 index, predicting a 10% rise by September 2021, with indications that industrial and construction material stocks will be amongst the sectors that benefit. ZTO Express debuted on the Hong Kong exchange on Tuesday. Its shares jumped 9% from the offer price. And three Apple Inc. suppliers are planning to invest about $900 million in total to India. All right. At the same point in time, Harley Davidson is making its exit from India. So a lot to digest, a lot to speak about. Let's turn now to Arun Pai, Chief Strategy Officer at Flow, the brilliant mind who helps us dissect all the market news. How are you, Arun?
I am very good, Michelle. How are you?
Doing good. Did you watch the U.S. presidential debate live?
Of course I did.
All right. So you caught all the action. Biden repeatedly calling Trump a clown, telling him to shut up. Trump talking over the answers. But we did see S&P futures flat immediately after the debate, but futures rose as much as 0.7% during the debate, and we saw stocks rise, at least in the U.S. markets, after investors seemed to like the fact that banks weren't immediately pounced on or used as bashing boy. And in terms of tax policy, well, the market seemed to have reacted positively. But what is your take on the market's reaction?
I mean, you know, I think cringeworthy was the word you used, and that was quite an apt description for the debate. I mean, there was no substance in it, right, where neither candidate could actually truly, like, explain what their agenda is going to be, what their plan is if they become president or stay as president for the next 4 years. It was quite a mess overall, you know, which is great for, like, late-night comedy talk show hosts. Mm-hmm. But from the market perspective, it was kind of a non-event in a way. I think personally, I found, Biden could kind of hold his ground, and there was a lot of speculation that Trump would, like, literally run him over. In terms of some polls that came out, be it by CNN, which might be biased to some extent, there was like a 60-30 odds that Biden actually performed a lot better in the first debate. But taking us back to 4 years ago, that was exactly what happened with Hillary versus Trump too, where Hillary dominated the first debate, and things obviously went south for the Democratic Party after that. Mm. I think the points that you mentioned about lack of any information about banks or healthcare or anything like that led the market to say, okay, you know, things are going to be as is until November 3rd itself. There's going to be no true insights from either of these presidential candidates. And hence, it's going to be relatively whipsawing up and down, which is what we saw. Markets were relatively flat. Then they started rallying a bit. Not pretty much of the news of this, of the debate, I would say, but just generally macroeconomic news and coronavirus, etc. I think, so overall, I think these debates are just going to be pure entertainment. Apparently for the second and third debate, they're going to have this option to, like, cut off the mic of one of the candidates.
I wondered why they didn't do that yesterday. You know, if they had me a stage floor manager, that mic would have been cut off, or it would have been disappearing into the floor like they do during the Grammy shows.
I think it's just a matter of respect to potentially the most powerful man in the world. And you would have hoped that it would have turned out to be a lot better, but sadly... Oh, well, it is what it is. But, coming back to the markets and stuff,
yes.
Obviously, no winner was decided through this debate, in my opinion, even though I think Biden might have come off slightly on top. The polarization of the voter bank is so extensive in the U.S. right now that you could literally hear statements from viewers on both sides, and they thought their candidate did a much better job than the other. So, you know, based on that, based on what the markets also are realizing of this, doesn't seem to be any change. One thing that was quite interesting, though, I found was that bookmakers in Vegas kind of increased the odds of Biden winning by like a couple of percentage points. And, you know, money talks. So it's interesting to see if Biden can still hold his ground over the next two debates and the probability of his winning continues to streak slightly higher. And, you know, it's within the realm of the possibility of error of like 53-54% versus the rest. We could start seeing some hit on the healthcare stocks, especially because that's going to be one of Biden's big and the Democratic Party as a whole, one of their big agendas to try and ensure that the private companies in that space don't take advantage of the consumer in the U.S. So I think other than healthcare as like one relatively large sector play, depending on how the debates go in the next month and who eventually becomes president, I think that's one place to watch out for. From the investor point of view, I think one big red flag is going to be if a president is actually not elected at the end of that election day on November 3rd, because that can lead to a whole bout of uncertainty, you know, with the case being taken up by the Supreme Court and it being delayed by a month or 2 months, not knowing what the end result is going to be. It could turn really, really bad very, very quickly. And I think that's one Six Sigma event that people need to be, you know, cognizant of.
Okay, so you're next looking at the point of whether or not there'll be a contested election, because that could bring more volatility. Not so much whether the rhetoric is going to ramp up in debate two and three.
I don't see, I mean, the rhetoric is going to ramp up from both sides, right? I think both parties saw what happened the last 4 years ago. I'm sure Biden's going to come out swinging equally hard over the next two debates too. But I just don't see any true direction for the markets, at least, from the perspective of either candidate actually being able to truly enunciate what they are looking to do over the next 4 years. It's going to be continuously name calling, talking about their families, how, you know, a son took money from Ukraine and blah, blah, blah. It's not going to change anything. But from the perspective of, and I'm sure like odds will flutter around plus or minus 2-3% unless something truly dramatic happens. But from an investor's point of view, that's very difficult to gauge. What is possible to gauge, though, is on a live basis, what is happening state by state, you know, when the votes come out in the U.S. And if it becomes a bit too close to call, Trump has already come out all guns blazing that he's most probably not going to accept it, and they're going to escalate this to the Supreme Court. And when that happens, you know, markets hate uncertainty. That's the one thing that it really, really detests. And, you know, if the House of the most powerful position in the entire world is left vacant for some time, relatively speaking, obviously, because Trump is still going to be president until the beginning of next year. But if there is uncertainty with that regard, then that's going to be a big question mark to the markets. And from these potentially frothy levels, we could see a decent correction.
I wonder if the VIX index is factoring in a contested election.
So it is. If you look at the term structure of VIX, option volatility has spiked up for post-election expiry, which makes a lot of intuitive sense. So from that perspective, you know, the market is very savvy that way. As an options trader in the past, you know, that is one element of the market where, sure, while you might have like Robinhood retail investors pumping in a lot of money into single name stocks, overall, I would say the volatility market in the current state is relatively efficient. And hence, you know, if you want to buy a single name option or an index option expiry prior to the November election versus post, you'll be seeing a massive premium difference. And that is to compensate the market maker of that option to hedge against the risk of a massive move one way or the other, depending on the outcome of the election.
Great insight there. Arun Pai, Chief Strategy Officer at Flow, joining me in Money and Me. JP Morgan likes the S&P 500. The bank forecasting that the S&P 500 will rise to 3750 by September 2021, a potential 10% jump from its last close. JP Morgan predicting that industrial and construction material stocks will be among the sectors that will benefit as the U.S. markets hit fresh highs over the next few years. Is it time to buy into the S&P 500, Arun?
Broadly speaking of the report, I agree with it for the following reasons. Firstly, they know very well the Fed put is in place. Interest rates are going to remain zero for the foreseeable future, which is a massive tailwind to pretty much any asset class. I think it was interesting where they mentioned, based on data over the past couple of months, we are seeing the economy rebound quite vigorously, albeit from quite low levels. Based on data, unemployment, factory expansion, consumer confidence that just came out, I think, last night in the U.S., very, very bullish numbers. So leaving aside the elections, which is more of an event risk, looking at the market overall, is it frothy? Yes. But from the perspective of our interest rates going to be zero? Yes. Is there the economic recovery happening, which will directly lead to cyclical stocks performing better? Very high chance of it. I'm not going to try and be a JP Morgan or like an Oracle to claim that it's going to go up or down by like 10% or 15%. But there are a certain number of factors that I just highlighted, which will potentially, or odds are, that will lead the market to be slightly higher. And I think, Leon Cooperman, I was watching his interview yesterday or a couple of days back, a billionaire hedge fund manager. Hmm. I think he explained it quite interestingly, where he said the market can be categorized into three sections. Firstly, the FANG stocks, right? All kudos to them. Technology is done phenomenally well. And not just like eyeball on website kind of phenomenally well, but actually attaining really good top line and bottom line growth, maybe because of COVID, maybe just generally because they've managed to disrupt very traditional ecosystems. Hats off to them. Is it expensive? Yes. Second part of the market is the Robinhood segment, where you have like bankrupt stocks like Hertz and others rallying like 5x or 8x off the lows. A segment for a cautious investor to stay well away from. People, win lotteries all the time. Doesn't mean that you will be that person by buying some of these penny stocks, hoping that they'll go up 8 or 10 times. In the third segment is the rest of the world, which includes the cyclical, includes industrial, includes construction companies, includes banks, etc., where there are many pockets of value, which is someplace that investors should be focusing on quite a bit. And I think that kind of like categorizes the market. I found it to be quite interesting, which kind of ties in with the JP Morgan report too, of where they potentially see the overall market going over the next year or 2 years.
All right, time for our China market watch. Shares of logistics provider ZTO Express jumped more than 9% from the offer price of 218 Hong Kong dollars per share. The firm is New York listed. They sold 45 million shares in their secondary listing in New York, raising $1.27 billion to build more sorting hubs, expand capacity, strengthen network stability and competitiveness. So what do you think of ZTO Express?
Logistics as a sector, has done phenomenally well, especially given the COVID pandemic, of how people are ordering things from home. And just generally, like, that space has done really, really well. So from that perspective, does it make sense to do a secondary listing closer to home in Hong Kong, raise a bunch of capital? Absolutely, right? Take advantage of the current market situation, ideally utilizing it for the proper purpose of trying to grow out their business. And they mentioned in the report how they find specifically in like the cold chain logistics supply chain, it's a very fragmented market currently in China, and how they will be able to disrupt that space. So as long as capital is being raised for, very specific purposes that will truly help the shareholder in the long run, all for it. Are there many, companies that are out there taking advantage of the market levels for other purposes? Potentially, yes, too, sadly, right? Like you have Palantir went like IPO'd in the U.S. overnight, $22 billion valuation, never had a profit you know, in the history of the company, all sorts of privacy concerns. But again, massive pop-up in the IPO price from $7.25 to $10. And, you know, there's this company called in Hong Kong that listed, I think, like 2 or 3 weeks back called JoySpreader. Sadly, it's raised more than $100 million. It had over a 1,000 times oversubscription from retail investors. It sadly did not spread that much joy, and the share price actually ended lower. So I think it's very important that investors don't go down that mentality that any stock that IPOs is going to do phenomenally well for me if I just buy it at the beginning of the day and sell it at the end of the day. Mm. Very much like back in dot-com era, right? Where bets.com, cats.com, you name it, IPOs, retail investors buy it, receive like 100, 200% return in one day, sell it, and then think that life is good. It's making money in the markets is never that easy. In fact, it's extremely difficult. So it always, you know, keeps to pay attention and to take a slightly more cautious approach. Logistics sector, checkbox, you know, they have huge tailwinds to it. There are many companies in this space that have done phenomenally well. And there are many larger competitors too. So it's important to take a full sector view and a very specific company view before trying to just, without the hope that, you know, you can put money into an IPO and think you'll be able to make money on the back of it.
Very important point. We feel so much safer wading into the stock market with you here, Arun, helping us out. Arun Pai, Chief Strategy Officer at Flow, joining us this morning in Money and Me. What do you think? NTT planning to delist Docomo, wiping billions off its rival telecom shares. Big moves for this space, at least in Japan. Your take on the news?
So, you know, it was going to cost like $40 billion to acquire it. But from the perspective of NTT, it's trying to increase its stake from, you know, I think it was currently at about 66% and raise it all the way to 100%. Is the cost justifying, you know, this acquisition? Evidently not, because if you look at the market price today, based on this market news, entity, the parent entity company, was down about like 4%, I think, in morning hours. And Docomo, it's not been trading yet. So, you know, we're going to find out what actually, it's going to like obviously have a pop-up based on the valuation of where entity is acquiring it. From the perspective of overall in the telco segment, I think there's just so much competition and so much uncertainty over there as to how, you know, this mobile phones versus coming back home to like Singtel or StarHub, the number of paid subscriptions of television, right? How they're being dramatically cut. They have been dramatically cut in the last 4 or 5 years, how they will continue to be cut over the next 2-3 years. So I think overall, the telco space is going to be ripe for disruption. The purpose of acquiring the entire company as a whole, you know, I would love to read a lot more research reports and understand from the company management perspective of why they are doing it. At least of the reading that I've done so far, I don't truly understand what the end game is going to be, and definitely not what the game plan is by acquiring it for a certain premium and having that 100% control. So I think time will tell, or at least I would need to take a little bit more time to digest that news in more detail before I can have an educated opinion of it.
Let's turn to India, put our attention on India. Three Apple Inc. suppliers are planning to invest about $900 million in total in India in the next 5 years. Hon Hai Precision, Pegatron Corp., Wistron Corp., Foxconn reportedly planning to apply to invest about 40 billion Indian rupees. Pegatron will invest about 12 billion. Do you see this happening as a fallout from the US-China tech tussle? We talk a lot about the bifurcation of the world in terms of supply chains. What do you make of these three Apple suppliers turning their attention to India?
Conceptually, I think it's a really good move by India to try and take advantage, as you rightfully mentioned, take advantage of this massive fight that's going on between US and China and convince companies to set up onshore massive manufacturing plants, which will help infrastructure, help employment, potentially help like transfer of technology to some extent, and creating the entire ecosystem, right? Because once you set up a plant to manufacture an iPhone, in it goes like hundreds and thousands of parts, and purely because of logistical issues, it just makes sense for the smaller suppliers of that ecosystem to come and set up shop in close physical proximity to the main iPhone manufacturing unit. So from that perspective, absolutely. But I think India, you know, and being Indian myself, it's a bit of an interesting history, I guess, to the country. And it takes me back to this book I remember reading of Mr. Lee Kuan Yew, where back in, I think, early 1970s, where there was India's prime minister at that point of time, Indira Gandhi, had an emergency law where, you know, basically it became like a semi-dictatorship in a way. And at that point of time, Mr. Lee Kuan Yew went up to Indira Gandhi and said, look, this is your moment where if you do things correctly, you can truly make a massive difference to the future of India. You have a young population, you have an English-speaking population who are educated, not just in language, but in based on engineering and being doctors, etc. You can truly unify the country, which is a sad legacy from the post-British rule. And he said, this is your moment. This is the moment when you can truly make India change. And when, sadly, Indira Gandhi did not go down that path, Mr. Lee Kuan Yew was like, okay, you know what? India is not going to go anywhere. I'm going to go inside with China because the next 50 years is going to be all Chinese dominance in the world. And, you know, the oracle that he is, he turned out to be absolutely spot on, where China, taking a very central approach, ensured extremely rapid growth. Now, in India, coming back to like the last 4 or 5 years, ever since, you know, Mr. Modi's come into power, and he's trying to get rid of this red tape, get rid of this bureaucracy, try and have a unified nationwide tax system. It's easier said than done when you have over a billion people, I don't know, something like 100 different languages being spoken by different people in different states, etc. And we could clearly see that where, sure, on a headline basis, these companies coming on board, pumping in hundreds of millions of dollars, conceptually fantastic. But if you look at the last 2-3 years, you've seen Toyota come out recently saying that they're not going to expand. You've seen Ford set up a JV with one of the large Indian automobile manufacturers because they realize it's just too difficult for an MNC to operate there. General Motors left a couple of years ago. Harley-Davidson, as you mentioned in the beginning of the show, they're also shutting down operations over there, which is the world's largest two-wheeler market. And sure, albeit it's the premium segment, but the premium segment in cars has been doing quite well too. But sadly, you have a number of these manufacturing companies that have tried to set up shop over there, realized how difficult it is to actually do operations there, and after 2, 3, 4, 5 years of setting up shop, have sadly left. And this is in spite of the Indian government coming out this month saying, you know, we're going to try and give even more government discounts and tax freebies to automobile and other manufacturing companies in that sector to come and set up shop in India. So I think conceptually, the central government really wants to try and help, you know, assist growth in the country. It's just potentially going to be a lot more difficult to actually execute as compared to, say, in a country like China, where what the government says is the end-all, be-all, and everyone has to follow suit.
Just absolutely spellbinding. Terrific talking to you. Would you consider Harley-Davidson yourself? Because I can see you and your wife on it. Honestly, we'll make a good Instagram post. Tell her. Let her know.
I will do that. I think you'll kill me before that, but after putting on the Instagram post, given the social media savviness.
Always great talking to you, Arun Pai, Chief Strategy Officer at Flow, joining me in Money and Me.
Before acting on the information on Money FM, please consider if it's suitable for your own investment objectives, financial situation, and risk tolerance. To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download the SPH radio app available on Google Play or the App Store.